Hi, my name is Jason. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I initially asked Wes to share his story this upcoming April, and had his father. His father was supposed to share this evening, who is also my sponsor, but he's somewhere in the Caribbean, tanning or something like that. But when I asked Wes, he's always been there, and he said absolutely. And Wes is someone who means the world to me in my life, and someone I really look up to, because he lives his program, and it just shows the way he lives his life. And with that, I'm going to introduce someone who really means a lot to me, Wes.
Hi, my name's Wes. I'm an alcoholic and addict. And I'm very grateful to be here today and to be sober and have a second chance at life. And I remember, I'm always grateful during this time of the year because I start to think back on where I came from, and Ridgeview was one of those places. I actually am not an alumni, but I have been through Ridgeview a few times. So it's always good to come back and to be among the old-timers and the people just coming out. So I've always been told to tell my story as of what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So I'll start from the beginning, which was September 19th, 1976. I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My mother and father met in Pittsburgh while my dad was in medical school. And they got divorced when I was 2, so we moved down to Rome, Georgia, which is about 60 miles south of here. And I had a pretty good childhood. I, had everything I wanted as far as, I had food to eat, toys to play with, school to go to. And I was a fairly good child, probably up until the age of around 7 or 8. And that's when I really started getting into acting out. I was always a very grandiose kid. I always bragged about what my dad had or bragged about what I didn't have, and always wanted to feel one up on people and superior, and did my best to put down other people so that I could feel that way. And I carried that behavior over into the, I guess I was about 13 when I first got in my first little bit of trouble for stealing out of somebody's home and a friend of mine's home. And, I took about $400 or $500 worth of stuff. The police came, and my mother had the choice of paying the police and paying the people back and the police would leave, or she also had the choice of letting me go to YDC. So, of course, she paid them, and they left. So I kind of cooled down after that, and I think I had never tried any drugs up until that point. I had maybe drank a beer or two here and there. And when I was 12 years old, before I first came into Ridgeview, a friend of mine who was 15, we got the idea, and we stole $1,000 from his dad and his van, and we ran away out to California. And we got out there with, we didn't know where we were going. My intention was to be a rock star because I play guitar. And we got all the way out there to Los Angeles and Long Beach, and we were there for a couple days and just kind of living it up, the best a 12 and 15 year old can. And I ended up getting drunk one night and wrecking into a bunch of cars in the hotel parking lot, so we had to leave that hotel pretty quickly. So we left and we went to Las Vegas. And after being in Las Vegas for a night, the gentleman I was with spent all the money that we had on a prostitute. So now we had about maybe $30 or $40 left, and nowhere to stay, and didn't know anybody, and just me and him. All we had was that van and the clothes on our back. So we were, fortunately, we got caught coming out of Las Vegas. We had watched the movie Billie Jean, and it was set in Corpus Christi, so we decided we were going to go there. But by then, we only had about $15 in quarters left, so it was going to be a rough trip. But I was looking very suspicious at the gas station and standing in front of the license plate, and the policeman later told us he would never have pulled us over unless I hadn't been standing in front, because I thought the whole country was looking for us and that we were a lot more important than we really were. So we got pulled over, and I had the my parents had a choice of either bailing me out or letting me stay in YDC for 2 weeks out in California or Las Vegas, Nevada, and they chose to fly me back. And the other kid, Jay Youngblood is his name, and he chose to, his father chose to fly him back too. And the only difference is between me and him is that when he got back, his dad let him, you know, go out that night, you know, and he ended up later on killing himself or shooting himself in the head, and now he's pretty much immobile and is a vegetable and can't do anything for himself. But anyways, I got back, and my dad told me we were going to go see somebody. I don't know who it was, but it was here. So he told me we were just going to go visit him, and then we were going to go home. So we got here, and I found out I wasn't going home, and that was my first experience being thrown in the little white room or whatever with the pads all over the place. And I stayed here for about 2 months, and my behavior here really, it took me a couple years to kind of figure this out, but when I got here, as I said, I'd never done drugs before. Back then, I think I was on D-North or whatever it was, but they put the adolescent drug and psych together. So my roommate had done all these drugs, and when I was in there talking to him, I wanted to be like him. So, you know, I told him I'd done the drugs too and did this and did that. So he went and told the people, the counselors, and then they put me in treatment for using drugs. And, of course, I went along with it and was getting treatment for something I never even needed to be treated for just then, quite then. But so I stayed for 2 months, and I got out and went back to school. I was in a small private school then, finishing up the eighth grade, and I really liked all the attention that I'd gotten when I got back, because people really couldn't believe that a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old had ran away to California. So I got a lot of attention, and everybody wanted to know what we did, why we did it. So I kind of rode that out for about 6 months, and I did pretty good for maybe, I turned 13 in Ridgeview, and I did pretty good probably from the years of 13 to almost 15. And when I turned 15, I think that's when I first tried smoking marijuana. I was drinking all along, never been a huge drinker. However, the little bit that I drank did set me off, and you know, I never knew what was going to happen when I took that first drink, which is what qualifies me for myself to call me an alcoholic. So I started experimenting with acid and pot, and that was about it. When I was 15, I was doing very poorly in school. I just started ninth grade, and that was the first time ever in my life that I had, you know, not played sports and not really cared about what people thought about me or, you know, what my grades were. So I was mainly making F's, D's, C's my first year or two in high school. The second year, sophomore year, I pulled it up a little bit, but I was still doing pretty poorly. And my father was pretty out of touch then. He had not been around too much since I was about maybe 3 or 4 years old. He would come here and there and send me money for my birthday, but he was never there emotionally. So he was really like a stranger. So at the age of 15, I was, as I said, just jacking around, not really taking anything seriously. And I got arrested for watching a joint get sold in my car 3 months after that transaction had taken place. So that got me landed on probation. It got my dad a little bit more interested and seeing what was going on with me. Again, he came down and bailed me out, got me a lawyer. The lawyer got me off on probation, and I played around on probation, smoking pot while I was on probation, and just barely getting by. So when I was 16, my dad had the idea for me to come up to Atlanta and go to summer school because I need to start pulling my grades up. So I did that, and when I came up here, you know, I thought that this was all I needed. I thought Rome was just boring, and that's why I was getting in trouble because there was nothing to do. So I figured if I moved to Atlanta, then everything would be all right, and he offered for me to stay here. So I moved up here in my junior year, and again, I did good in the way of making good grades and not getting arrested and, you know, appearing like I was doing what I needed to do. However, inside every day, you know, I didn't have that release or that comfort of having a drug or a drink. And every day I remember coming home from school, it would just be an overwhelming feeling about 3:30 or 4 o'clock of just being alone and not really having anybody to relate to, and I just feel like I wanted to cry really strongly every day. I kind of was in a point, not where I really hated life, but I just had a real hard time emotionally during the year from 16 to 17. And when I was 17, I hooked up with a gentleman that used to go to, or that dated a girl that I used to go to school with in Rome. And I began selling drugs and just started off real small and here and there. And then I really got into that. By the time I was about to graduate, my dad came in my room one morning 2 weeks before I was about to graduate after I'd pulled my grades up. And he went off on me for not taking the trash out or something. And I just decided that was it. You know, I was making enough money selling drugs, so I was going to go and do that on my own. And so I moved out and quit school 2 weeks before I was about to graduate and moved in with a friend of mine and began selling drugs full time. I was doing very well with them at this time because I wasn't doing drugs anymore. And so I realized it was going to be real hard to make anything of it if I was doing it. So that lasted for maybe 3 months, and I remember every time I'd see somebody doing cocaine, I'd think they were so stupid, and I'd think that was, you know, I'd never do that. That's the worst drug you could ever do. I'd see people shoot it and smoke it, and, you know, eventually, you know, somebody talked me into trying, or I let myself be talked into trying snorting cocaine, and I did that, and from the next year, I was out of control with that and just did it every day, and life was really crazy then, and I got arrested when I was close to the end of that year, when I was about to turn 19, on Delk Road. And the sad thing about it was the same policeman had pulled me and the same person over 3 months before in the same car with the same expired tag and told us never that he didn't ever want to see us on that road again with that in that car with the expired tag. And so we had gotten pulled over, and I got out, and they had him in the car because he had a suspended license now and an expired tag. And so I'd been up for maybe 4 or 5 days on coke, and I decided to take off running. and they caught me on Powers Ferry and beat me up pretty bad and took me to jail. So, you know, my dad came to see me, and, you know, I cried and said, "Dad, get me out of here. I swear I'll never do it again." So he put his house up for me and got me out. And, you know, he didn't even want to see me the first night. So he dropped me off at one of my friend's house and told me just to get ready to go into a treatment program if I wanted to stay out on bail. So he put me in some halfway house that I don't know where it is, over near Shamley Tucker. And I was in there for a day and decided I couldn't take it. So I called my friends and told them to come get me. And I just, you know, took off and wasn't thinking about that he had put his house up for me or, you know, any of the liability that he was sharing here. And he always told me from when I was a real small child, about 6 or 7, when I really started acting out and getting in trouble and at school and doing all kinds of bad stuff, he'd always tell me, "You're going to get in trouble one day, and I'm not going to be able to help you." And he would constantly tell me that. He's like, "One day you're going to get in trouble, and I'm not going to be able to help you." He's like, he would tell me that every week. And so, yeah, he bailed me out. I took off on him, and it took I went back to selling drugs, and it took the bounty hunters that he sent out about 8 months to find me, but they did find me. they put me back in jail, and I was in there for 60 days this time, and my grandmother gave in to my crying and wanting to get out, and so she bailed me out. I went to court on the charge in Cobb County that I'd had. They had gotten it dropped. They got the drugs dropped because the police had beat me up so bad and gotten it dropped to obstruction of justice. So I went to court drunk, and I don't know how I got out of there, because when the judge asked me to stand up and, you know, come to the front of the court, I stood up and turned around and faced the back of the court. And my lawyer at that time, my dad was paying for the lawyer, so he told me that he was just going to tell him that he couldn't represent me and that they would give me time to get, you know, counsel. So I did that. I got a lawyer. I got off on probation, and everything was fine as far as my legal problems, but I had gotten deeper and deeper into selling drugs, and I gotten to a point where I was robbing people, not me personally. I'm not a very violent person physically myself, but I was a very vindictive and mean-spirited individual who had some people who were didn't have enough sense to and listen to what I said, and would go and rob people and rob other drug dealers, and that's how I justified it, is they were doing wrong, so it was okay. So I had really gotten into that. I was paranoid all the time. By this time, I was doing a lot of meth and ice, and just always had these crazy schemes going on in my mind, and I had been on probation, and you know, I'd never reported to that probation. I got off and first offenders, and I just never reported, because I couldn't do anything that I was supposed to do. You know, I couldn't act like a responsible individual. I don't know why that was, but I just couldn't bring myself to fulfill any kind of commitment. So I flipped out and realized I had a problem one day when I'd done too much meth, been up for about 6 days, and flipped out on the people I live with, ran down Roswell Road into Kroger. I thought that all these people that I'd robbed were coming after me to get me. I threw all my drugs on the counter at Kroger and pushed all my money towards the manager and told him that I'd give him all that if they just didn't kill me. And so he called the police on me. He called the police. I went out front, and you know, I was thinking, if I'm going to die, I'm going to die high. So I'd eaten a gram of meth, and I just laid down. And the next thing I remember was waking up and hearing a lady talk to me. I remember a policeman taking all the stuff back out of my pockets, and a lady in the ambulance talking to me. And I found out later the only reason they didn't arrest me and take me to jail right then is because they wanted to spare me dying in jail. But that charge did come back to haunt me in the form of a drug trafficking charge. After I was in Grady. I woke up in Grady and was very disoriented. They let me use the phone. I was wondering why I was in the normal part of the hospital, but I knew that if I was going to leave, I needed to get up and go then. So I finally, my roommates wouldn't come get me because I had the police at the house. I'd freaked out, and the police had ended up coming to the house, and they thought I was turning them in or whatever. We were all crazy. So finally somebody came and got me, took me home, and I swore I'd never do any of it again, and I was going to straighten up. And within 3 days, I was back at it and doing what I was doing again. I had quit doing it then. So leading up to this time, I'd kind of straightened up off the drugs, but was still into selling them heavily, and I ended up getting arrested one more time. I got set up and got arrested for a pound of marijuana. And so I thought, you know, I didn't say anything. The people I was with, I was with my girlfriend and a few people from Rome. So I was always under the impression, my lawyer told me, don't say anything because that admits you know something. So I didn't say anything. And when we were at the police station, I'd given them a false name at first, and finally I gave them my real name and social security number. And we were listening to the radio as the police were going around telling all the people in the room that they didn't want to go to jail for me. You know, I was this, that, and the other, and they were going to go to jail for 35 years or some crap. And We heard about come back on the radio, John Wesley Hauser, black male, 6'1", 19 years old, wanted for, there's a warrant out for armed robbery, felony murder, and something else. I don't know what else I said, but I really wasn't, I didn't care after I heard the murder and the armed robbery, so that was a pretty big surprise. I knew something bad was coming, and I'd done a lot of bad stuff, but, you know, I was kind of surprised to hear that, and then it really didn't sink in because I was still kind of in a daze from the drugs, and I ended up going to pretrial, which is downtown, I think on Fulton Street, I'm not really sure, but I stayed there for about a month. They bounded over and sent me to Rice Street, where I stayed for 18 months, and it was really, really crappy, but so during that whole time, it was one of the best things that happened to me, because during the time of me being in there for the first year, I still wanted to get back out and do the same thing. And if I had have gotten out, I would have went out and did the same thing. And I saw it over and over. I'd see people come in on murder charges and get off on a technicality, and you'd see them back 3 weeks later on another murder charge or another armed robbery or whatever the case was. So I sat for a year without any want to change. I just didn't want to change. I was still going to do it on my own. And I remember one day, I guess it was about 15 months, I was able to get into a recovery program in there, and a recovery dorm in the jail. And I just was overwhelmed, and I got on my knees and I asked God. I didn't believe in God. I just said, whatever you are, whoever you are, if you can hear me, help me, because I can't do it on my own anymore. And I think that was my first really honest prayer, because before then, I prayed a lot when I got arrested for murder. I was reading the Bible, reading Psalms, you know, quoting Scripture, and nothing happened. So I kind of gave up on it after, and I thought that God didn't do anything for me when I asked him, which was a crock. And I said that prayer, and immediately the next day, I got a court date. I had been waiting forever, because they had been waiting for me to testify against some other people, and I just couldn't do that. So although it was a very hard decision not to do it, I couldn't do it, and finally I got a court date. And when I got the court date, they dropped the case, and they didn't have enough evidence, was what it was. They needed evidence from me that I did not give. So fortunately, they dropped the case, and on the trafficking case, the drugs that the cops had taken off of me and that I'd left in Kroger, that came back on me, and they said they couldn't find the evidence on that, which was amazing. And I think that was God working in my life, or actually I'm sure that was, you know, moving me when I finally made a decision to do something different. So from there, I still had to go back and face the wreckage I'd made done in Cobb County, where I had not reported to probation, so I had a violation there. And I stayed in Cobb County for about 2 months, and I thought I was going to get out. We had the deal worked out with the DA, and when I got in the courtroom, the probation officer changed her mind on me. And I remember that was one of the saddest moments of my life as of yet, because it was the first time I'd ever seen my father get up and defend me in the courtroom and try to put a word in for me. And my mother broke down crying when they told me that they were going to give me another year, which actually was the best thing that they could have done for me. So I'm very, very grateful that that happened. However, I had plans to get out, and I was set on it. So I still realize now that because of the pain I felt, that I still had my will, and I wanted it my way, which I didn't get, thankfully. So I went to boot camp, and you couldn't get anything at boot camp, no, nothing. So the one book I did get was a big book, and, you know, I had it, so I said I might as well read it. And that was the first time I'd read a literature before, but never heard it, never sunk in. So I finally read it from cover to cover. By the time I had finished reading it, I was about halfway through, and I was ready to get out and go do whatever I was going to do. And then my dad suggested that I go into a treatment program. And, you know, I said, I don't think so, Dad. I think, you know, now that I've been out of the game for a little while, I'll be okay. I can just get out and go along and do what I have to do. But as I started getting closer and closer to being released, I realized that I had nothing to stand on, you know, and I had had these false dreams that I was going to get out and everything would be perfect, and I start out on top up here, and it just wasn't like that. So I did get released, and, you know, I didn't know what to feel the first couple of days after I got released, because it had been a total of maybe a little bit over 2 years, and that's the longest I'd ever been in jail up to that time. So I turned 21 in there, and just really, I was ready to get out, but I was actually becoming institutionalized, I believe, because I was pretty out of sorts when I got out, because everything's done for you there. So when I got out, I, you know, went and ate and spent time with my family, and I was really, really spaced out, and didn't know why I wasn't happy. And that night, I remember crying myself to sleep in my mother's arms, because I realized that I had to change, or I had to go back to what I was doing. And those were the only two options. So the next day, I went up to my dad's in Atlanta, and they took me over to a place called Primary Purpose. And I went in there and talked to the guy, and one of the first things he said is, he said, "You'll never make it." He said, "You got too big of an ego, and you don't want to listen to anybody, so, you know, I bet you're not going to make it." And so, you know, I'd always up to this point just, when people said or challenged me, I'd say, "Screw you," and go do my own thing. And, you know, take my will back and do it my way. But for some reason, I stuck in there. And the only thing that I did right during that time was probably not drink. And it was a 3-month program of a lot of meetings and a lot of rules and a lot of regulations that you had to follow. And whenever you're in a halfway house with a bunch of other drunks, 6 people sleeping in a 3-people apartment, it's there's a lot of personalities clashing, and it's tough. And so I made it through that, and I got out, and I went to a place called Hope Homes, which really helped pave the way for me, for my success today. And I'm very thankful to the owners of that, one of which is here. And I stayed there. I planned to stay there for 6 months and leave and go do my own thing, but I ended up staying for 16 months. And during this whole time, I really wasn't working any type of a solid program. I was kind of still doing what I wanted to do, and didn't have a sponsor, myself, so and that never works. So I went about a year and a half without, you know, just going to meetings, and I was going to meetings 2-3 times a day, and that did work for a little while. I wouldn't suggest it, but one day I got a sponsor, and he started taking me through the steps, and once I got through the 5th step, that's when I really felt things. I felt a clear hope, and I was always focused on what I was wanted to get. Like, I was focused on getting a good job or making more money or getting a good girlfriend, and that's what I was focused on that first year and a half. And when I got the focus off of that and put it on my program, that's when all those things that I wanted started to come to me. And it's amazing where how it's panned out today. But when I finally went through the steps with a sponsor, that was really the first step to where I'm at today. And I met another sponsor who was really, really hardcore and told me what to do, when to do it, how to do it, who to do it with, and had me staying after meetings from 9 o'clock till 12 o'clock, and just really knew how to piss me off and push me to my limit. And but he was real good for me, and he had me working with guys, and he had me working with other drunks, and that's what kept me sober. He just had me constantly going up to people, sticking my hand out, and you know, saying, "Hi, my name's Wes. What's yours?" And you know, helping people, and that's what this thing is about for them, and for me today too. So I have just been very, very grateful to have a lot of good people in my life to help me through this, and just to be able to find a God of my understanding, which I never had contact with before. I went to, you know, a Christian school for 9 years and never thought about God once, and until I was 21, you know, when I said that first prayer. So today I have a lot of good friends. I still attend meetings regularly, try to do 5 to 6 a week. I've been sober for almost 5 years, close to 6 years if you count the jail time, but I don't count the jail time, just the time that I'm in AA. So it's amazing. You know, my God is, I've worked hard for it, but he's given me everything that I was struggling so hard to put in front of AA before. And then when I switched my mojo around and put AA first, it's amazing what I've gotten. And he has given me, you know, a job and a business that I love. I work with people that are just great, and it's continually amazing me every day at the stuff that happens, because I got out of jail and I was working at Kroger for $6.55 an hour and riding a bike all over the place. So it's just it's incredible how you know, God has done stuff for me, and I try to stay grateful for that. And the way I do that is by working with other people and staying in touch with alcoholics, and not just alcoholics, helping anybody I can, and really focusing on trying to treat other people like I'd like to be treated, which is a difficult task for me, seeing I'm very selfish. So that is about it. I'm going to leave a little time for the people to get their chips, but I really appreciate you guys having me out, and thanks a lot. Thank you.
Thank you, Wes.